This is The 11th Hour. I'm Páraic Branagh. Welcome to this week's selection from The 11th Hour podcast. William Hogarth is one of Britain's most famous printmakers, artists and satirists. His work features historical snapshots of 18th century England, but with an edge. From fussily dressed gentlefolk trapped in loveless marriages to stolen, lustful embraces, to a London populated by harlots, rakes, drunks, rapists, quacks, fakes and libertines, his pictures can certainly tell stories. We asked author and art lover Frank Wynne to go to a major exhibition of Hogarth's work currently on view in Tate Britain in London. Frank Wynne, you're very welcome to The 11th Hour.
It's lovely to be back.
We're talking about William Hogarth, one of Britain's most famous artists. Is he one of their greatest artists?
He is. I mean, if for no other reason than actually he's commonly called the father of British art, and there is nothing before him. I mean, this is turn of the 17th century. He's born 1697. At this point, there are no schools for teaching art in London, although there are sort of in France and on the continent. And for the most part, I mean, the aristocracy are importing artists. So Hans Holbein is being brought over, Van Dyck is being brought over. So French and Italian artists design and paint the great houses of the rich, but there's no British school of painting until Hogarth. He single-handedly invents it.
You mentioned Holbein there, who came over to England to paint portraits. Art was essentially portraiture at that time.
It was very much portraiture, and actually even within portraiture we're talking about the portraiture of the aristocracy. So we're talking about the major nobility, kings and princes, minor aristocrats who could afford to have it done. Generally very formal portraits. They were not seen sort of at play, in repose. They were, you know, in their uniforms, they were in the full gentlemanly get-up that said who they were to the world. It was a public, having your portrait painted was a public statement rather than something that you did privately.
There was no, as you said, there were no art schools. Where did Hogarth get his training? Where did he learn his skills?
Well, Hogarth comes out of Grub Street. His father was a Latin teacher, but he'd also been, he was a failed writer. He had ambitions to write, and rather like the sort of Grub Street hacks that Alexander Pope would end up satirising, really thought of himself as a sort of literary figure. And actually, that was what ended Hogarth's father in the Fleet Prison as a debtor. So actually, he was utterly incapable of finding any way of training as an artist. And so he became an apprentice to a silver engraver, but I mean, not top of the range. He wasn't doing silver engraving, he was doing silver plate engraving. So this is like your business cards, visiting cards that are handed out, funeral notices. So most of it was just copying and recopying the same thing. And eventually he personally abandoned that and set out on his own to do illustrations, initially for the books that were being published in Grub Street. So, I mean, he did a series of his own engravings for a book called The New Metamorphosis, and then began to do major satirical engravings of his own, which he then sold to booksellers. They would do the print runs and sell them on, and he would make his money in that way.
This was a change in the art world, this illustration, the selling on illustration, the illustrated books. This was a new thing.
This was a completely new thing. I mean, prior to this, art was very much the preserve of the aristocracy. In order to buy a painting, you had to buy the time of an artist who was capable of doing it for you. And though there was beginning to be a sort of wealthy middle class who aspired to having art, it simply wasn't possible for them to do so. For Hogarth to turn engraving into an art form in itself, and to create a genre which both sort of the lower and the middle classes and the minor sort of genteel people would aspire to having, actually was what made his fortune, much more so than selling individual canvases.
He created a series of paintings that had a moral to them, like The Rake's Progress, The Harlot's Progress, Marriage à la Mode. These were comic books, were they, sort of the time?
Well, I suppose in some way. I mean, an awful lot of art very much sort of told a story at the time. There would be very complex symbolisms which those who knew about art would understand. The difference with Hogarth is he's investing it with a very British edge. He's very much against the sort of refined French and Italian sense, which was in as much as there was an influence in British art at the time, that was it. And he draws much more, I suppose, on the Dutch school of painting and ennobling the peasants. But these are what he called his moral tales, his modern moral series, the subjects were effectively the forerunner of all serial art, from comic books to motion pictures to whatever. And what's extraordinary about them is that, although there's a certain amount of text within them, this was art for people who couldn't read, and these were stories and novels for people who couldn't read. I mean, they're very similar in their approach to the great novelists of the day. So, I mean, his great friend Henry Fielding's Tom Jones and Joseph Andrews, and also John Gay, who wrote The Beggar's Opera. These are the sort of social satires that were being put on the contemporary stage in London at the time, and in the first novels of Fielding and later of Laurence Sterne are being played out. The difference being, of course, that the great bulk of London at the time would have been illiterate and unable to read books like this. His were versions which anybody could understand.
You mentioned The Beggar's Opera, John Gay, the very famous representation of that, which gave a sense of what theatre was like in London at the time.
Very much. I mean, he was very much a fan of The Beggar's Opera, and he returned to the climactic scene in it about three or four times, certainly, maybe five, which is the thing about The Beggar's Opera. The reason it pleased Hogarth was it was using high art for low ends. So here was an opera with songs and so on and so forth, in which the hero was McKeith, who's a murderer and a con artist and whatever, and the villains are actually the lawyers and the judges. And by the time you come to the closing of it, you have this impossibility to end it, because McKeith is our hero, so we don't want to see him executed. On the other hand, he's been a cad and a villain to the only two decent women, Polly Peachum and Lucy Luckett, who are fighting to have him released, and it's their fathers who are keeping him imprisoned. And so all of this irony isn't lost on him. I mean, he knows that on the one hand, McKeith doesn't want to be released. He can't possibly make a choice here. But he also knows that the fundamentals of the way storytelling was written at the time meant that an opera like that didn't have... it always had a happy ending. It never had a sad ending, and therefore McKeith couldn't go to the gallows. And in some sense, certainly, once he begins A Harlot's Progress, which is about 4 years later, he's working on a similar model to that of John Gay. He's taking low subjects and ennobling them with high art.
This was a response at the time in London. The Mayor of London and other officials were trying to ban prostitutes. Prostitution was seen as the moral decay of the society. Hogarth responded to them by telling this moral story in six pictures?
It is, yes. And, I mean, for Hogarth, he clearly has, at least initially, some sympathy for the harlot. I mean, she arrives, an innocent country girl, carrying a goose under her arm for her cousin who lives in the Thames Road, and is looking for directions and is approached by this woman who's a pander. And I mean, certainly people in London at the time would have recognised her, I mean, from other engravings. She was called Mother Needham, and she preyed at places like where carriages stopped on young women and brought them into prostitution. And it then follows her career. She's taken in by a wealthy Jew, and you can see, I mean, as you said earlier, all of this is about detail. You can see that now she has the trappings of an aristocratic life. She has a small Negro houseboy. She has a monkey. She has fine china and the masks that she would wear to a masquerade ball. But she's not satisfied with this. I mean, by the second portrait, she's attempting to cause a distraction to her actual lover, while her other lover, her bit on the side, is nipping out smartly. And what she doesn't seem to realise is that she's not nearly as central to this man's life as she thought. So by painting three, she's actually the paintings themselves, unfortunately in this case, have been lost, and only the engravings survive, whereas in The Rake's Progress we still have the paintings. But by the third, she's back to being a common prostitute. She has delusions of grandeur. And again, I mean, a lot of the hypocrisy of the time is manifest here. So on the one hand, she clearly thinks of herself as being religious. She has a communion wafer pinned up beneath an etching of a celebrated preacher of the time. But on the other hand, she's wrapped her butter in a letter from the Bishop of London. She's doing a line with a famous, perfectly genuine highwayman at the time, and at the same time, the judge is beating down the door to get into her. And it follows her then through prison, where, as women in the Bridewell did, they beat hemp. And of course, hemp was used for making rope and noticeably for making the hangman's noose. And through her own death, and actually the most touching of them is very much the funeral at which she isn't mourned. I mean, the people standing around her coffin, for the most part, are prostitutes themselves. The only person crying has just cut her finger. Mother Needham is wailing, but more over the lost prophet she's going to have. The woman's child is ignored. The cycle has come full circle. The only person who seems to have been enlightened is the one person staring down into the coffin, who seems to have seen that this will be her future if she doesn't do something about it now.
Going back to the first picture, what amazed me about this whole story was it was kind of shocking when I looked at them in detail. In the first picture, you have her future lover fondling himself with anticipation of getting his hands on her in the background.
Absolutely.
Of the
picture. What's extraordinary about Hogarth is quite how explicit he allows himself to be and was allowed to be.
And all the symbolism of the priest horse knocking over the buckets, which suggests the clergy were complicit in this. And
this is also sort of a nod to the virginity that she's about to lose, what is going to be broken and so forth. Yes.
All these symbols that people at the time understood that we have to actually study now to get the full meaning of.
Well, as William Hazlitt, the great critic, said at the time, Hogarth's pictures are not made for contemplation. They're made to be read in order to be able, you know, in a period of six panels, to sum up an entire life. The only way in which he could do this was to include all sorts of extraordinary details. There would then, I mean, as in The Rake's Progress, there would have been great literary allusions, and there would have been allusions to great European painters. I mean, he wasn't about to put off his rather more genteel patrons. On the other hand, he was quite an... He very much appealed to sort of the middle classes, to the classes that he himself had come from.
Just to finish up on the Harlot's Progress, the last panel of it in the funeral, the parson has his hand up a girl's skirt.
You know, here he is. He's officiating at the funeral of this dead woman. He's having a quick grope. Nobody is paying any attention to the poor boy who's just been orphaned. There's a couple in the corner who are bickering over a bottle of brandy. Nobody actually cares about her. Her life is sort of lived. She's been exploited, used. She's dead. And as you said, life goes on.
And this actually sold 1,200 copies of this series of six prints sold at that time, which is an extraordinary thing.
It's an enormous amount to have sold. And actually, from his point of view, this was a very good thing. He found that the modern moral subjects were rather difficult to sell as canvases, partly because they were part of a series, and nobody was going to buy all of them, and partly because they weren't the sort of things that, let us say, the sort of minor nobility would hang in their drawing room. On the other hand, as prints, and while he did many of the engravings himself, he also had a workshop of engravers, sold, as you say, I mean, 1,200 copies was enormous in a population of London at the time, which probably couldn't have been more than about 50,000.
The Rake's Progress was another one in the series. This had eight paintings in it, and it described a man's journey into decline.
Well, this is also a reversal of it, because if the harlot is a victim of exploitation, she's a young country girl, the rake can't blame anyone but himself. I mean, his only great privation in life is the fact that his father was a bit stingy, but his father was clearly rich. What he then does, having had the best education lavished on him and having had all the wealth, is he fritters it away. I mean, it begins while his father is still alive, being measured up for a suit, and his father clearly penny-pinching. But once he comes into his own, I mean, by the second painting, when he's now rich, he's aping all of the general accoutrements of the aristocracy. So his livery, which is when you get up in the morning, but when you get up in the morning and you're posh, you're surrounded by people who not only, you know, bring you your breakfast and bring you your clothes, you have a valet and a footman and a manservant, but you also have people who are selling you things, you have your composer. I mean, if you're a sort of minor person who's the son of a merchant, what on earth are you doing with a composer? But he has a composer, and this one's quite deliberately modelled on Handel. And again, the exquisite details of these things. If you look at the print and the detail, the composer is composing an opera called The Rape of the Sabine Women, which in turn is funnier because he's written down the names of all the actors who get the parts of the rapists. And they're all very famous Italian eunuchs who were singing as castrati. So for the more that you knew about art and the more that you knew about culture, the funnier and the cleverer these were. But actually the basic moral intent of the story was clear to absolutely anyone.
So he goes from inheriting money, prancing about in his fine clothes in the morning, to partying. Then he ends up getting accosted by the bailiff. The girlfriend he had denied saves him. He marries an old woman, restores his fortune, loses in a gaming room, ends up in prison, and the last scene is death. And the interesting thing about the death scene is There are voyeurs there. There are two people who have paid to come to the prison.
Well, indeed. I mean, this was true until the 19th century, that it was possible to go into places like the Fleet Prison. He dies in Bethlehem, in Bedlam, the Bethlehem Hospital, which was for the insane, because, of course, he has syphilis, which he contracts very early on. Almost everybody in all of Hogarth's drawings in The Moral Progresses are, you know, have little black pock marks from syphilis. But as rather beautifully and rather touchingly, Sarah, his girlfriend, is cradling him, rather like Christ and the Pietà, there is a rather sort of posh aristocratic woman with her maidservant in the background, who's paid to visit the Bethlehem in order to laugh at the fools, and who's taking great interest in a madman who's peeing up against a wall. And this was, again, one of the things that Hogarth does in this and does in The Four Times of Day, is he's extremely aware that in portraying the poor, and particularly in portraying the sins of the poor, or the sins of those who, you know, there but for the grace of God, that we are being voyeurs, and that frequently we are being enormously hypocritical in doing so. So you'll frequently find that the observers in his paintings, as they are in The Four Times of Day, will appear on the surface to be well-dressed and out for a stroll, but if you look more closely, you'll find that actually they bear all the signs of a hypocrisy, which means that, you know, they're not only inured to this kind of spectacle, they don't care.
He was very conscious of what was going on around him. The series Marriage à la Mode was based on a play. That's a very interesting series, because that was a kind of a big commentary on the social structures of England at that time.
Well, it's absolutely a comment on the ways in which arranged marriages were worked. I mean, this is a play by John Gay, who'd written The Beggar's Opera. He was very much a fan of the theatre. He, when in his own self-portrait, which is a portrait within a portrait, in which the canvas that's already painted sits on the books of Shakespeare and Milton. So he's drawing himself directly out of this mould. But once he gets into Marriage à la Mode, what he's railing against in part is the sort of adoption of what is foreign and what is fashionable at all costs. So, I mean, you begin with what is a marriage contract. The two people who are about to be married, nobody cares about. The young man is gazing into a mirror, is not remotely interested in the girl he's about to marry. She's the daughter of a merchant, he's the son of an earl. And the earl is portrayed, though he's clearly got gout, as this sort of rather decadent Wattle kind of figure, while the merchant is portrayed as a sort of Dutch burgher, rather in the mould of Peter de Hoogh or somebody. But the problem for Hogarth of an arranged marriage was not simply that it was loveless. It was that it paid no respect at all to any form of propriety or decency, even aesthetic. I mean, the second painting after the marriage shows the two of them in their own drawing room. He's just come back from a night on the tiles. He's got another woman's hat in his pocket. She's been up all night notionally playing cards, but the fact that the chair has been overturned makes it look like she's probably had a lover in. But actually everything about them goes against the grain of what Hogarth believes. So, you know, they have a fake classical bust next to Chinese statues. They have a room in which there are paintings of saints next to a painting of an amorous relationship of Jove and nude. All of these things, from his point of view, are not only in poor taste, but actually they lack any empathy for real life and for actual beauty. And of course, by painting three, when the husband goes to the doctor's surgery, not only does he already have syphilis, and syphilis was a scourge at the time, there was very little you could do except take mercury pills, which actually would simply make you worse and in all probability erode your nose away. But I mean, in this, both the doctor, the old woman who's there, and even the rather beautiful portrait of the child who's standing in the doctor's surgery, they all have pockmarks. They clearly all have syphilis. There's an acceptance that this is sort of part of the life that they lead. Meanwhile, his wife, having the old earl having died and now being a countess, entertains her lover in her bedroom. This is the sort of comedy of manners that isn't going to happen again effectively until Oscar Wilde. But actually, in his case, the comedy is very much undercut by the absolute savagery with which he depicts these people.
the last panel on that is the lady's death and the wee baby being held up to kiss his dying mother. And it also has a pockmark on its face.
Absolutely, it's which is very, very touching. And, I mean, again, there's an amount of parody in that. There's a famous scene in Samuel Richardson's Pamela, where, you know, the child is presented to the loving mother who, you know, etc. And there had been a very famous painting of that at the time. And he's parodying this with, you know, a woman who's dying, whose child is being presented to her to say goodbye. And actually, the child is already doomed.
Moving on to another series of paintings that did, the Before and After series. They were extraordinary in their time, too.
Well, the Before and After series, yes, I mean, they prefigure all of this. I mean, the Before and After series, the before in each of them is two panels or two separate paintings. And the before is in the tradition of Watteau and François de Troyes. So these are the sort of French fête galante. You can see generally a young man pressing his affections on a young lady, and she's coy and demure. Everybody's terribly beautifully dressed. Their hair is impeccable. This was absolutely within the tradition of what was being painted at the time. What he does is upsets the apple cart by painting a second painting of what happens afterwards. So in the first of the sequence of before and afters, we see them after. They've clearly just had sex, sort of in the middle of a field. They're disheveled. They're sort of out of sorts. There is no longer anything romantic or gallant about them. There's no longer any sense of that kind of courtly love, which was supposed to be the underpinning of such paintings. But as you said, what's extraordinary about them continues as they go on, because in the second of the series, it becomes increasingly clear that what we're witnessing is not any form of courtly love, but a rape. In the second of the before and after sequences, the first is a woman being sort of pulled onto a bed by a man very much against her will. And again, symbolism is everything. She's knocking over a mirror, which, when it breaks, is her virginity. And there's a little dog sort of running around very excitedly on the ground, which is his rampant desire.
And the cherub in the background as well, with the rocket about to go off.
Absolutely.
Which is really graphic.
Absolutely. And then the second panel, which is more somber. I mean, he's the man, although he's clearly satisfied sexually, clearly isn't satisfied. He looks depressed. He's dead-eyed. He's staring into space, getting his clothes on. She's pleading with him, and almost certainly, even though she'd been raped, she would be pleading with him not to say anything, because that would destroy her virtue, even though it is more or less lost. The little dog is asleep. The mirror is broken. Her world is effectively in ruins. This is an extraordinarily graphic way of looking at things which previously were only ever alluded to.
It was very bold and risque, you know. In the first one of those series, like, they're practically naked, or they're exposed to genitalia and all this.
In the second of them, you can actually, I mean, as he's getting dressed, as they're getting up from their roll on the turf, you can actually see the genitalia. This was an extraordinarily risque thing to do in something other than a classical nude. The nude was fine as long as you were, you know, if you were portraying Ganymede or if you were portraying Venus, that was fine. But the notion of a courting couple, and where you can see him putting his breeches on and you can catch a glimpse of him is extraordinary at the time.
I wonder, was Hogarth making a comment about the nature of men in society at that time and the power they had over women, or would that be just too sophisticated?
I don't think it's too sophisticated. I mean, I'm not sure to what extent he would have been able to articulate it, but it's certainly true that the women in all of the moral paintings are, by and large, victims. You do get people like Mother Needham, who is a pander, who is exploiting others. But if you look at the long-suffering girlfriend who bears his child in The Rake's Progress, who tries to get into the church in order to stop the marriage to the elderly woman who's rich, these are all women who are exploited. Even the elderly woman is being exploited. All of these women effectively owe everything that they have to what a man is prepared to give them and must take whatever they're given. So certainly he's aware of that at some level. And he was very much, in terms of his career as a philanthropist, supporting both St. Bartholomew's Hospital and the Foundling Hospital, very aware of women, and particularly women who gave birth out of wedlock. That was something that was rather important to him.
He painted extraordinary scenes in London itself. Particular ones, was it Gin Street and Beer Street? Or?
Gin Street and Beer Street. Beer Street and Gin Street, well, Beer Street exists in a couple of versions because these were engravings. He could revise them as he went along. And Beer Street, when he starts out doing it, seems to be a sort of paean to all that is good about beer, in that it shows a navvy with a tankard of beer in one hand lifting up a Frenchman with the other, because the Frenchman, obviously being a foreigner, will be a weakling because he doesn't drink British beer. But again, you know, you'll see what's extraordinary is that it's teeming with life in a way that, and particularly of a certain working class life, which we won't really see again until L.S. Lowry in the 20th century, so that you have, you know, a whole slew of sort of drunkards and pawn shops and gin, on the other hand, was, I mean, long before it was ever called Mother's Ruin, he felt to be very much an ill, and this is sort of women neglecting their children, women who are now sort of fallen through the evils of drink rather than beer, which was, as it were, a manly substance.
There was a gin epidemic in London, and that the Parliament tried to ban gin on two occasions. And this was like, he was like a photographer, really, taking the picture of what was going on around him and commenting on it.
It was said, though he was among those who said it, that when he did a thumbnail, he literally did it on his thumb. He firmly believed that you didn't sit in front of something and then depict it, that you caught it on the hop, that you memorised, you had an image in your mind, very much like a snapshot, and that this is what you were reproducing, was life in the raw, in all its variety, in all its colour. But there is also, I mean, an enormous thrust of what the work ethic is. I mean, the sequence, which is called Industry and Idleness, which on the one hand depicts a lowly man rising to become Lord Mayor of London, and on the other hand a rich man sort of diving into the depths because he's idle. There is a sort of rather Protestant work ethic behind it.
Of course, Methodism and all those religions were coming to the fore at that time.
And he's very interested in both Methodism, both as a prod in order to get people to do things, but also the enormous hypocrisy. I mean, he portrays a lot of his lectures in brothels will have, you know, a puritanical pamphlet sticking out of one pocket and a woman on the other arm. He's very aware that religion as professed is not per se religion. I mean, he famously did a wonderful portrait of a bishop in Wales who had managed to be bishop there for 4 years without ever actually going to his diocese.
He was also important in terms of a thinker about art, about the aesthetic. The line of beauty is one of his inventions, isn't it?
The line of beauty is his phrase, and of course the one which eventually gave Alan Hollinghurst his title for his novel. It comes from his own theories, which he advanced in two books. What he favoured, the line of beauty is the figura serpentinata, if I've got that right, which is the sort of slightly curved line which runs through the great Italian sculptures of the Renaissance, through Michelangelo and through Raphael. And from his point of view, what he was contrasting it against was the very stiff, Northern European, formal, rigid. And he does a whole series in The Analysis of Beauty, his book on the subject, of his own engravings. So he will show a sort of pompous, straight-backed English dancing master, and he's next to a classical statue of Antinous. So you can see immediately that what is beauty is the one rather than the other. And in fact, there's a rather beautiful illustration in it called The Country Dance, in which in the marginalia, what he's done is reduced every single pair of dancing couples to a single line so that you can see whether it's a curve or a straight line, a square or a diamond, and let you know what he's doing. But he had a much greater sense than that. I mean, he favoured, in a way that was very un-Italianate, the decentralised subject, more than one focus in a painting. I mean, this is very, very true in his conversation pieces, where you have a formal group, which tend to be the adults of the family, being subverted either by the maidservants or by the children who are sort of racing around about to topple something over. So undermining the formal sense that such portraits would have had before then. And he likes intricacy of effect. I mean, he said that simplicity without variety is wholly insipid. And certainly simplicity is what he's looking for in terms of simple lines and features, but those represented in their infinite variety.
He started off his career painting portraits, then he moved on to his moral series in his engravings. But towards the end of his life, he painted a very famous portrait called The Shrimp Girl.
He did. In fact, he more or less retired in about 1757 and decided that he would dedicate himself entirely to portraiture. And most people saw that, I mean, he had previously rather scorned portraiture. He felt that it was sort of money for old rope, as it were. Though actually his portraiture is at odds with the very formal portraiture of the time. And The Shrimp Girl is an excellent example of it. He's catching a fleeting moment of someone. He's very much looking to catch a play of light, the play on a face. This is not about formal portraiture. It is not about people sat enthroned. It is about the humanity of people. And, I mean, if you look at The Shrimp Girl, it's almost a sketch. I mean, had it been done 200 years later, it would have been considered impressionist. But actually is entirely fully formed. And one gets the impression he quite literally passed her in the street. And he introduced an awful lot of the humanity into... I mean, I said earlier that he... was a patron of St. Bart's and of the Foundling Hospital. He did a number of wall paintings for them. And what he did, and this caused an enormous amount of controversy, was to introduce this sort of humanity into historical and religious paintings. So the wonderful painting of Moses being brought before Pharaoh's daughter, the child, which was done for the Foundling Hospital, the child was almost certainly modelled on a foundling child. It's a heartbreaking portrait. And this is not how one portrayed Moses. I mean, yes, he is a foundling child, but actually he's a prophet and therefore he's always displayed as ideal. And there were a lot of, certainly, artists and art critics at the time who felt that he was debasing the historic form and debasing the biblical form by doing this.
The Shrimp Girl, when I saw it, I didn't believe it was one of his works because there was no line in it. It was all brush strokes. There was none of that hard illustration or engraver's edge on it. It was just very...
It is one of the extraordinary things about going around the exhibition, because actually everyone knows Hogarth as an engraver. You have a sense in your mind of the engravings. Many of the series, things like The Rake's Progress and Marigella Mode, even in their painted versions, have that sort of hard and crisp edge to them of that. But what's extraordinary about the exhibition is showing you a side of Hogarth that you haven't seen. And as you say, there are no hard lines. There's almost no definition in The Shrimp Girl. It's floating and ethereal. It could have been a Degas study. It's in near monochrome with flashes of pink and brown. It really is extraordinarily impressionistic, 200, 250 years before Impressionism was even thought of.
That's what I find amazing. It does look like an Impressionist painting. And that this guy, Hogarth, had worked for a long number of years before he painted this. But he seems to have curtailed his style of art within his engraving or his style, but then he seems to have, inside himself, he seems to have this other art that wanted to get out or something. Is this something?
Yes, I mean, he very much wanted to be a historic painter. He very much wanted... I mean, I don't think he felt constrained by what he was doing in terms of his engravings, but certainly he needed and wanted to do much more than that. In the very late portraits, there's an extraordinarily beautiful portrait, a composite portrait of the heads of the six servants who worked in his household.
That's beautiful.
Which is worthy of Degas or of Rembrandt. I mean, these are extraordinarily compassionate individual portraits of people who otherwise simply wouldn't have been depicted at the time, in a style that is utterly unlike anything that he was doing at the time, and utterly unlike his early portraits. I mean, his early portraits were done in a slightly caricatured style. I mean, he was famously asked to do a portrait of a man who was a notorious drunk and painted him sort of with a hangover, throwing up into a chamber pot at, 11 o'clock in the morning.
That's funny, isn't it?
commissioned by the wife in order to get him off the drink.
So it's extraordinary. That one was amazing because the wife commissioned the painting for your man as a moral lesson to him.
But it was the same. It was his own family who then had it painted over, and they had the chamber pot painted over so that it looked like he was reading a newspaper instead. They've only restored the chamber pot fairly recently. But no, I mean, he's the late. There is a great late flowering in the portraiture, where he begins to strip away all of the other.
There's no symbols. It's just a character.
No symbols, just people.
There's a series of little children that's amazing. There's a couple of families that he painted, three or four children playing or in a room.
One of the things that he does, of course, is he begins to subvert the previous sort of conversation pieces by showing children playing at being adults. So this is, on the one hand, it's an incredibly beautiful way of looking at children because they're at their most focused and concentrated, attempting to sort of be adults in the world, which both gives you much more of a sense of them as children, of the ephemeral nature of childhood, but also subverts an existing genre of family portraits. But yes, the portraits of the Graham children and so forth are extraordinarily beautifully realised. And there is a much greater sense of just stark humanity in this, as there is in say, his portrait of Thomas Herring, the Archbishop of Canterbury, where he paints him without the robes, without the robes of state, without all the accoutrements, almost in black and white, almost in grisaille, as it were an ordinary man. He is still wearing the basic bishop's robes. But actually, again, the painting was criticised because the Archbishop's face is too candid. It's too easy to be able to tell what he's thinking. Whereas, of course, portraiture at the time was intended to mask feelings, not to reveal them. They weren't drawing from Rembrandt and from those who were looking for a psychological insight into their subjects. They were drawing from French portrait painting, which was about how one presented oneself to the world. And Hogarth is instrumental in paving the way for Joshua Reynolds and Thomas Gainsborough, who will come 20 years after him. I mean, they're beginning to work just as he's coming to the end of his career. And without his influence, could never have been the portraitists they became.
It sounds like it was really a fascinating and a wonderful exhibition to go and see.
It was. In fact, I've been to it twice and will have to go again, simply because there's so much to spend time on. And I mean, this exhibition is half the size of the 1971 exhibition. I can't imagine how long you'd have to spend on it. It's partly the richness of styles. A friend of mine said that when you go to an exhibition, there are sometimes when you get exactly what you thought the artist was. You went in thinking, I know what kind of artist he is, and he turns out to be precisely that. With Hogarth, you get much more than that. You go in thinking you know what he does, and actually he does that and much more.
Thank you very much, Frank Wen, for reviewing the William Hogarth exhibition, which can be seen in London's Tate Britain on the 29th of April. For more information, see www.tate.org.uk. I hope you enjoyed this week's edition of the 11th Hour podcast. The 11th Hour is live on RT Radio 1, Mondays to Fridays at 11 p.m. From me, Páraic Branach, and the rest of the team in the 11th Hour, Slán.